This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Biographies and Memoirs. Learn the life stories of your favorite contemporary and historical figures and the struggles and victories that made them who they are. World leaders, scientific innovators, creative minds, and celebrities inspire our own lives with their stories. It's Biographies and Memoirs, now on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Biographies and Memoirs, and I'm your reader, Margaret Ankenbrook, with the audio reading service of the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the book Through the Glass Ceiling to the Stars, the story of the first American woman to command a space mission. The book is by Eileen Collins, USAF retired and NASA astronaut, with Jonathan H. Ward. Now I'll begin with Chapter 8, A Dream Come True. If this were not already the most momentous and challenging year of my career, another opportunity came along that I couldn't pass up, the chance to apply to the NASA astronaut program. NASA selected astronaut classes on average every 2 or 3 years during the 1980s, the latest one announced in June 1987. At that time, I didn't feel I possessed the qualifications of a competitive candidate. Then NASA issued a call for applications in early 1989, shortly after my acceptance at Edwards. Talk about a dilemma. I didn't want anything to distract me from my work at the test pilot school. I also realistically knew that this might be my single best shot to apply for the astronaut program. Competition was so fierce that I might not make it on my second, third, or even a later application. It gets tougher every time because each succeeding year, applicants learn what boxes need to be checked to become even stronger candidates. It was now or never. I filled out the mountain of paperwork and mustered the courage to ask the chair of the Academy's math program to write a recommendation letter. He agreed, to my relief, and surprised me by saying I'd make an excellent candidate. I was one of almost 2,000 people to apply that summer. 2,000 people who, like me, saw this as the chance to fulfill their lifelong dream. NASA whittled that list down to about 100 candidates to interview. In late September 1989, I received a call from Dwayne Ross, the administrative officer of the Astronaut Selection Board. Dwayne had administered every selection board since the beginning of the shuttle program, and he was highly respected. He asked if I could fly to Johnson Space Center the first week of October for a week-long interview. I immediately agreed, although I needed permission from the school commandant to miss a week of classes. That wasn't a sure thing. I had only been at the school for 2 months. The critical section of the curriculum dealing with longitudinal stability was scheduled that week in October. The instructor of that section, Ray Jones, was a legend in the test pilot community, so much so that the top award for flight test engineers is named after him. I didn't want to miss his week-long class, but again, this was the chance of a lifetime. I asked the school commandant. He deferred the decision to Lieutenant Colonel Warren Hansen, our operation officer. Oh no, I thought. There's no way he'll let me take a week off from school. Hansen was a quiet man. I was never sure what he was thinking, and he often came across as a tough personality. He seemed to be a gruff, admission-minded pilot, at least in front of the students. As I sought the courage to ask Hansen for permission, my mind went into overdrive. I couldn't help but wonder, had he also applied? Was he previously interviewed by NASA, or maybe turned down by NASA? Did he feel the rest of the students would think I was unfairly getting special attention? I reasoned with myself. He will start with no, so I must work on my elevator speech and be ready to convince him that this is a chance of a lifetime. I approached him near his office and began telling him about the call from NASA. Before I could start on my rehearsed persuasive speech, he said, "Yes." Pilots and astronauts hate what we call a single-point failure, meaning that if something goes wrong, there is no backup or workaround. To this day, I realize that Hansen was potentially a single point of failure in the chain of events that would lead to my becoming an astronaut. Despite his reserved nature, he seemed to care about his students as individuals. He could easily have said no, and that one word might have prevented me from ever becoming an astronaut. My task next was much easier, buying a business suit to wear to the interview. Since I had received only 1 week's notice, there was just 1 weekend to buy a civilian suit. As luck would have it, we had a school trip to Beverly Hills to attend the Society of Experimental Test Pilots convention scheduled that weekend. I skipped out of the convention for a few hours and bought a NASA blue suit at Robinson's department store in Beverly Hills on sale. A whirlwind week in Houston. Looking back to the astronaut interview week, I'm still amazed at how at ease my mind was as I approached this examination that would decide my future. Yes, it was an exam. Every move we made was watched and judged from the moment we met the van that picked us up from the airport until they dropped us off at the airport at the end of the week. Frankly, I was just thrilled to visit Johnson Space Center, JSC, to see the facilities that ran our space program and to meet my astronaut heroes. I only wanted to enjoy this opportunity. I didn't want nervousness or to clog my memories or disrupt my performance. During my van ride from the airport to my hotel on NASA Road 1, I met John Grunsfeld, an astrophysicist from Caltech who was interviewing for an astronaut role. John didn't make the cut that year, but NASA selected him during the next round in 1992. Years later, John would be the astronaut guru behind the last three of the Hubble Space Telescope repair missions. He would eventually become NASA's chief scientist. I learned that ours was the second group of interviewees out of 5 groups total. I was one of this week's 20 candidates. NASA would interview about 100 people this fall and select a yet-to-be-announced number of pilots and mission specialists. The pilots would train for flying the shuttle on launch, orbit, entry, and landing, and would eventually command space shuttle missions. The mission specialists would perform spacewalks, operate the shuttle's robot arm, and conduct science experiments. Our first official interview day was a Sunday. That morning, we took written psychological exams. As I met the other candidates prior to sitting down, I could see how diverse we were in background, experience, and our mental states. Some of us were talkative and friendly, some quiet, and others clearly nervous. We spent a long day taking timed written tests like the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. After about 5 hours, we were fed up with answering questions like, "Do you love your mother?" What a relief to go back to the hotel for dinner and conversation. We spent about 90% of our time over the next 5 days in medical screening. This included the normal expected exams like vision, hearing, and doctor's evaluation, and also more invasive procedures, mammograms for the women and proctology for everyone. We were wired up with heart sensors. The men had their chest hair shaved, then the skin cleaned with alcohol. Ouch! And ran on a treadmill. The doctors wanted to see our heart function at a specific high rate, and if we didn't reach that rate, we had to run harder. I was only 32 years old, and I wondered why I had to go through these procedures. The answer was, NASA will be investing a lot in you. We can't have you removed from flying status at a young age for some physiological problem we could have foreseen. We need you to be healthy for decades to come. There were more unusual tests. My favorite was the claustrophobia screening. A technician attached a blood pressure cuff to my arm, sweat sensors to my fingers, and those pesky heart monitor stickers to my chest. I crawled into an inflated balloon about 3 feet in diameter, which looked something like today's exercise balls. Once I was inside and curled into the fetal position, the technician zipped up the back of the ball. For obvious safety reasons, they hooked up a hose to keep air circulating. Examiners told me I would pass this test if I stayed inside for 30 minutes. That was a piece of cake. I fell asleep, just as I had done in the Air Force POW camp isolation box 12 years earlier. I was so relaxed that I actually felt sad to come out, like having to get out of bed on a Saturday morning. I pondered the people I knew who were seriously claustrophobic. I asked my technician, "How many people have failed this test?" She said only one person in the history of astronaut candidates had failed. Perhaps those who are claustrophobic don't even bother to apply. There were several more enjoyable events of the interview week. We were each assigned to watch a simulation in mission control. We went to Ellington Field to view the T-38 aircraft and then visited the Weightless Environmental Training Facility, a huge pool used for spacewalk training. Thursday night, we had a social event at PT's Cajun Barbecue near the airfield. On the bus ride over to PT's, some of the candidates said, "This event is the real interview. They want to know if you are socially inept. Don't say anything stupid." I still wonder why some of our candidates put so much pressure on themselves. I looked to the social event as a chance to meet more astronauts and hear about their individual experiences. I had a great discussion with Mike Lounge, an astronaut who flew on the first mission after the Challenger accident. He accused me of doing my homework, and I laughed. I had closely followed his mission just 1 year earlier as his crew so bravely led the space shuttle program back to successfully flying again. Little did I know then that I would eventually command NASA's next return to flight mission 16 years later. Our hosts encouraged us to walk over to Building 4 in our free time to visit the current astronauts whose offices were on the third floor. I went over a few times, but unfortunately found only a couple astronauts, as most were out working somewhere else. The most feared part of the week, even more than the actual interview, was the hour with the psychologist. I was actually looking forward to having a good time talking with this guy. Many of my fellow candidates were petrified. After about 30 minutes with the shrink, I started to become concerned. First, he told me I got 7 questions wrong on Sunday's personality and psychological exams. He asked me, "Tell me about your hallucinations." That floored me. "Huh? I don't have hallucinations." "But you answered true to the question. When I walk down the street, I see things other people don't see." "Yes, I did answer true. When I am with my husband, for example, I'll notice flowers, landscaping, and people's clothing while he has no clue they're there. He looks at other things." "Well, that question is designed to find out if you hallucinate." I started feeling defensive. "Sir, with all due respect, someone who wants to be an astronaut is not going to confess to unusual mental issues." The interview went on and on like that. Then he started asking me about my mother. "Do you love her?" "Good grief, of course I do." Then he asked me, "Are you doing this for her?" I lost it. "No, I am not doing it for her. She doesn't want me flying jet airplanes around the world, risking my life as a test pilot, and now wanting to strap myself into a rocket just a few years after the Challenger accident." I'm not sure why he didn't disqualify me at that point. Someone later said that the astronaut selection board doesn't actually listen to the shrinks unless there's some kind of serious concern, so I shouldn't worry about that part of the interview. I faced 2 risks of DQ, disqualification. The first was the hearing test. The technician put the headset on me, but she didn't place it precisely over my right ear. It was a simple test that I easily passed every year in the Air Force. I listened to the tones, pushed the little button as requested, despite the noise in the hallway. Here was an important lesson. You are in charge of ensuring proper collection of your data. I should have either correctly placed the headset or asked her to fix it before we began the test. Instead, feeling confident, I thought, no big deal. I've never failed a hearing test. Well, I failed this one. Later that day, Dr. Richard Jennings, the chief doctor of the clinic, called me in and asked in a loud voice, as if I were deaf, "What is wrong with your hearing?" I explained that what I thought was the problem, and he sent me back for a retest. This time, I put the headset on myself, and I asked the technician to close the door to the hallway so I didn't have to listen to extraneous noise. Result, I passed. The second and more serious risk of DQ was the eye exam. I had issues with passing the visual acuity part of the Air Force test when I was in college and my first year in pilot training. The acuity requirements were looser for an astronaut, though. Instead of 20/20 for both near and far vision, a pilot could be 20/40 uncorrected, but had to be 20/20 with glasses. I passed this part with no problem. However, I failed the primary depth perception portion of the exam. I later learned that visual depth perception is the number one reason pilot candidates are DQ'd. The doctor let me take an alternative depth perception test with a different kind of target, and I passed it easily. Starting with the next class selection in 1992, NASA eliminated the alternative test, and all pilot applicants had to pass the primary test or be DQ'd. That was the new standard practice until the year 2000. That year, when I went in for my annual medical exam, the eye doctor said to me, "We're changing our depth perception eye test to now allow the alternate test again." The medical board figured that since you successfully landed the space shuttle with no problems, maybe our requirement was too strict. If I hadn't been selected as an astronaut in 1990 and had to reapply in 92 or later, I would never have been a space shuttle pilot because I couldn't pass that primary depth perception test. Another lucky break. The interview. The crux of the week was the big one, my in-person interview with the selection committee. This board had about a dozen people, chaired by former flight director Don Putty, the chief of the flight crew operations branch. A candidate who interviewed before me said that Mr. Putty fell asleep during his interview. I suppose 20 interviews in a week can get pretty boring for the selection board. I was happy to have some free time before my interview. I went back to my hotel room, exercised for about half an hour, showered, ate, and took the bus to the astronaut crew quarters. It was a simple one-story building back in the northern corner of Johnson Space Center. I walked in, said hello to Administrative Assistant Teresa Gomez, and took my seat in the lobby to wait my turn. I was excited, but not particularly nervous. I was looking forward to this chance to meet the astronauts and also to talk about my qualifications and how I could benefit the space program. Still, since I was still a student at the test pilot school, I thought they probably wouldn't be serious about hiring me this time around, which lifted much of my performance pressure. Some people had suggested that maybe the board just wanted to check me out for consideration in future years. During the shuttle program, prospective astronauts applied either as pilots or as mission specialists. The military would forward your application as a pilot only if you had graduated from test pilot training, either the Air Force's school at Edwards or the Navy's program at Patuxent River. Since I hadn't yet graduated from test pilot school, the Air Force followed its rules to the letter and had submitted my application as a mission specialist rather than a pilot. I was happy just to be able to interview. The pilot who interviewed before me walked out of the meeting room with a stone-cold look on his face. "Hi," I said. He just shook his head and walked past me. I thought, this may not be pleasant. But I will have a positive attitude, and I will not put them to sleep. I walked in and shook hands with everyone. I sat near the top of the open-ended rectangle of tables and waited for the first question. John Young, Charlie Bolden, Hoot Gibson, Dick Covey, Mike Coates, Rhea Seddon, Jerry Ross, and Mary Cleave were some of the questioners. I flubbed the very first question. Jerry Ross asked me, "Let's start with high school. What did you do in high school?" My mind started racing. As you know, my high school days were not the best. I was just sort of there. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't a math whiz. I didn't have the lead role in school plays. I mostly worked part-time jobs. And in the moment, I forgot about my part-time jobs. I drew a blank when I tried to think of something meaningful to say. I started chattering like a contestant in a beauty pageant. I wish I had applied myself more in high school. There are so many great opportunities. My message to young people today is to take advantage of the great opportunities. There are so many. Take a risk. If you fail in high school, who cares? You'll be preparing yourself for the future. Take lots of courses. Play a sport. Don't quit 5 minutes before you sing for the lead part. Make friends. Do some volunteer work. Talk to people. Don't be so shy. You can do it. Basically, I was thinking about all the mistakes I made in high school. After an awkward moment of silence, Jerry looked me right in the eye and said, "Oh, come on, weren't you a cheerleader?" What a scene. Where did that come from? I recalled trying out for cheerleader 3 times in high school and failing to make the cut each time. I did cheer for my church league in 9th grade, though. I finally answered, "Only 1 year." It was an awkward moment. Fortunately, after that, things got better. I learned a lesson here. I had started out on the wrong foot because of a question about a period of my life that I wasn't particularly proud of, much less able to answer about with some substantial evidence. I recovered, though, and I didn't let the misstep throw me off balance for the rest of the hour. In fact, I enjoyed the interview. I felt I handled the remaining questions well. I drew a few smiles here and there, especially when the interviewers went on to joke with one another. "Why do you want to be an astronaut? What does your husband think of what you're doing? What kind of car do you drive?" The legendary John Young, Apollo 16 moonwalker and commander of the space shuttle's maiden flight, asked me, "Have you ever been afraid in an airplane?" He knew as well as I did that every pilot's been afraid in an airplane. Instead of simply answering yes, I began, "Which time would you like to hear about?" Dick Covey asked me, "What do you think of the F-4? I knew John Young was the first pilot to land an F-4 on an aircraft carrier many years earlier during his Navy career. Despite all the test pilot complaints about the terrible flying qualities of the F-4, I had to say something positive. "Well, it's an airplane with lots of character," I honestly answered. Early in the interview, somebody asked me, "Wouldn't you rather be a pilot?" I had anticipated that question and replied, "I applied as a mission specialist and as a pilot. I would be happy to be either one." It seemed like everyone else on the panel asked me the same question. Even the last interviewer said, "Come on, you'd really rather be a pilot, wouldn't you?" I said, "I'm going to stick to my first answer. I'll do either one." I actually felt that way. All I wanted was to be an astronaut. When I walked out of the room, I felt light on my feet. What a great group of folks, I thought. A group of people I would love to work with. I had dinner with one of the other applicants after our interviews. We compared notes. He asked me how I had answered several questions, and I told him. He said, "No, that's not what they want to hear. You should have said..." I didn't let that rattle me. And no, he didn't make the cut. When I returned to Edwards after my whirlwind trip to Houston, I tried to put the interview out of my mind and concentrate on school again. I needed to make up for the missed work of the training. But I couldn't stop wondering, will they select me? And if so, will it be as a pilot or a mission specialist? The call. January 16th, 1990 began with a qualities evaluation flight in an A-37 light attack aircraft. After returning home from the flight, I walked past the school's administration office and I glanced at the message board. I saw my name on a single yellow message paper tacked to the bulletin board. It read, "Major Collins, call Dwayne Ross at NASA." My heart started beating a mile a minute. This is it. My future, my dream, the fulfillment of my work throughout my professional life. Cool down, I thought, maintain an even keel. I walked over to the landline and dialed the number. The sergeant in the admin office watched me. She knew what was going on and shared in my excitement. Teresa Gomez answered the phone at Johnson Space Center. "Hello, this is Eileen Collins returning a phone call from Dwayne Ross." "Oh, just a minute." Dwayne got on the phone. "Hello, Eileen. I'm going to connect you to Don Putty." Mr. Putty was not an astronaut. The rumor was, if you were not selected, an astronaut would give you the bad news. This was promising. He got on the phone and said, "Major Collins, I have a guy here who really wants to talk with you." I thought. I said, "Okay." The next thing I heard was a voice with a deep southern twang. "This is John Young. Do you still want to come to Houston and work for us?" "Yes, sir." John went into a long list of all the things that Johnson Space Center does, spending perhaps 5 minutes describing mission control, space shuttle engineering, T-38 flying, simulators, studying future travel to the moon and Mars, and the like. I can hardly remember any of what he said. He concluded with, "Do you have any questions?" "Well, yes, sir." "Will I be a pilot or mission specialist?" He laughed. "Pilot. Yes, pilot, you will be the first woman to pilot the space shuttle." Reflecting on the achievement, long after the interview, I learned about some of the things that went on behind the scenes with the selection board. NASA knew that the first woman selected as pilot would be under intense scrutiny. Her reputation and NASA's would be on the line. NASA had previously interviewed two other female pilots, but the selection board had reservations about them. Astronaut Mike Coates later said, "It's not fair and it's not right, but the first person to break a barrier is under tremendous pressure, and it has to be somebody that almost can't fail. We needed the first female pilot to be somebody who was a slam dunk." Astronaut Mary Cleave was apparently the first on the selection board to recommend considering me as a pilot. The board extensively investigated my performance throughout my career. Mike Coates joked that they even interviewed my kindergarten teacher. "I'm happy that everyone they talked to vouched for my abilities and my character." With as much humility as possible, I felt I was up to the challenge and I wouldn't disappoint them. I felt a sense of mission and a renewed dedication to the importance of space exploration. My new profession would incorporate my lifetime of curiosity, scientific interest, and love of problem solving. And I would not only be the first woman to pilot the space shuttle, I would be opening up opportunities for other women to fly in space. I knew I had to be the best I could be. If I performed well, other women would have these opportunities, and young girls could aspire to these possibilities. In hindsight, piloting was the correct role for me. That's where my experience and expertise lay. Although I would have enjoyed being a mission specialist, I had been flying since I was 20 years old, and that was my talent and passion. The agency was ready to select a woman pilot, and I'm honored that they felt I was the right person at the right time. After receiving the call, I felt more relieved than excited. I didn't feel like celebrating or buying drinks for everyone at the officers' club or calling everyone I knew. Instead, I experienced a profound sense of calm, of peace. A huge weight had lifted off my shoulders. It just felt right. There were many places the Air Force could have sent me after test pilot school, and I probably could have been happy with any of them. I felt called to fly the space shuttle, though, and I knew it was where I belonged. I had to keep the news secret from everyone except Pat until NASA made the official announcement the next day. There were several other pilots at Edwards who had interviewed but were not selected. I worried about how they would take the news about me, especially since I haven't even graduated from the program yet. If anyone resented me, though, no one ever said anything. My parents and siblings were stunned at the news. Although I had dreamed of this day since I was a little girl, it was a dream I kept entirely to myself for more than 20 years. Pat knew, obviously, but my family back home had no idea that I was even considering a career in the space program. Few of my colleagues in the Air Force knew either. Frankly, I rarely told anyone I wanted to be an astronaut because I suspected they'd tell me that I couldn't do it. My brother Jay said that he and my mom just stared at each other in disbelief when I told them the news over the phone. My sister Margie witnessed Challenger explode from her home in Orlando, and of course she was worried about me. I reassured Margie that I was confident NASA had found the problems and corrected them. I had no reservations about flying on the space shuttle. I still had half a year of test pilot school ahead of me before I was to report for duty at Johnson Space Center. My astronaut position was contingent upon my successful completion of the program. I graduated in June 1990 and reported for duty in Houston in July. For once in my career, after years of frustration, the timing worked out perfectly. Chapter 9, Becoming an Astronaut. Pat and I moved to Houston right after graduation from test pilot school. I reported for duty on July 16, 1990, one of the 23 members of NASA Group 13. I was now officially an astronaut candidate, or ASCAN for short. Susan Helms and I drove to JSC, Johnson Space Center, together that morning. We were friends from our days in graduate school at Stanford, as well as our years teaching at the Air Force Academy. Susan had encouraged me to apply to the test pilot school while I was in my first year of teaching. She applied to Edwards and attended as an engineer 2 years before me. Now we were both ASCANs. I felt energized as I prepared to meet my fellow future astronauts in the same room where we had interviewed last October. I had an embarrassing faux pas while getting a drink before sitting down. I walked up to Dave Wolf, a medical doctor with an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering, and I introduced myself. "You already introduced yourself over there," said Dave. We just broke out laughing. Well, here we are. We were all smiles. Don Putty sat us down and said, "Welcome to Johnson Space Center." We were ready for his congratulations and all the niceties a new commander typically likes to gush. "But no, not today," Mr. Putty said. "You are coming to NASA at a difficult time." He showed us a clip from the previous Sunday night's 60 Minutes program, which asked, "What's wrong with NASA?" This year was a particularly tough and embarrassing one for NASA. After a long delay following the 1986 Challenger accident, NASA deployed the Hubble Space Telescope in April 1990, only to find out that its mirror was fundamentally flawed and its $1.5 billion mission was in jeopardy. NASA removed two astronaut commanders from flight status for a year because of unapproved activities in airplanes. The entire space shuttle fleet was indefinitely grounded due to fuel leaks recently discovered on Columbia and Atlantis. NASA had to investigate and correct those leaks before any shuttles could fly again, and it was still less than 2 years since the return to flight after Challenger. NASA's reputation, and perhaps its very existence, were on the line. "NASA has a public perception problem now," Mr. Putty continued. He emphasized to us that we needed to understand this and operate in an appropriate manner. Well, that put a slight damper on our day, but I want to emphasize it was only slight. We were all elated to be there, and we were all ready to start a year of training, of growing closer to our dreams of flying in space. We headed over to Building 9, home of the Space Shuttle mock-up trainers, to meet the press. Our group included 7 pilots and 16 mission specialists. We each introduced ourselves with enthusiasm, expressing confidence in humankind's future in space and conveying our desire to make a meaningful contribution to that effort. The press didn't want to hear about our lofty dreams. Instead, they focused their attention on those of us who were a novelty in their eyes, primarily the 5 women in our group. Nancy Curry was an Army helicopter pilot and had been a NASA engineer. The brilliant engineer Janice Voss had a PhD in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT. Mission specialist Susan Helms would eventually become the first American military woman to fly in space. Ellen Ochoa was the first Hispanic woman selected as an astronaut. She would eventually become the director of Johnson Space Center. And there was me, the first woman pilot in the history of the U.S. space program. My classmate Tom Jones said that he and the other guys were happy to let us women deal with the reporters. Getting started. Among our class's first tasks was to name ourselves and design a patch. The patch design took on a life of its own over the next several weeks. Since we were the 13th group of astronauts, we designed a patch with a black cat and the number 13 and named our class the Hairballs. Our mentor astronaut, Kathy Sullivan, told us that NASA headquarters would never approve our patch. The shuttle mission that was originally to be STS-13, before NASA renumbered the missions, submitted to headquarters a patch with a black cat on it. Management rejected it. "Don't bother," Kathy said. "It's already been tried." I don't remember if we actually sent it to anyone in the chain of command. Some other class members designed a patch with the Earth, Moon, and Mars. The NASA PR people were already describing our group as the space station astronauts and adding that some of us would go to the moon someday. How did that work out? We christened a more conservative and traditional patch, but the hairball's name still lives on today. Later that week, while we were still wide-eyed and learning our way around, the chief of the astronaut office, Dan Brandenstein, called a meeting for our class only. This was one of the most memorable meetings for my years in training. Dan lost several of his classmates and friends in the Challenger accident just 4 years earlier. We greatly respected him from the outset, and we were thankful for his advice. He talked to us about fairness, a subject I had never heard a boss discuss before. He said, "Nothing here is fair. I cannot make it fair. One of you will fly first, and one of you will fly last. It's not fair. I can't fly all of you at the same time. Therefore, I want you to be thankful you're here, and I want you to all support one another. When the first of you is assigned to a flight, the rest of you should do all you can to support him or her and that flight. Eventually, you will fly, and that person will be supporting you." The Astronaut Selection Board looks for each candidate's ability to get along with others, work together, communicate effectively, and keep a positive attitude even when things are falling apart. That's a tough trait to spot and grade. The Selection Board does the best they can. Sage advice from the boss, delivered without preaching, can prevent a lot of problems and stress by setting the right tone. Dan's words helped our class encourage one another through all the tough times we faced during the ensuing years. Flying the NASA T-38s. As a pilot, flying was my first priority in ASCAN training. NASA operates T-38 aircraft as spaceflight readiness trainers, the same as my beloved Air Force T-38s. Astronauts fly the T-38 in the real world, not the structured and safe environment of a simulator. Astronauts need the simulators for shuttle mission training, but there's no better way to prepare for stressful situations than flying in an actual high-speed airplane. If you crash in a simulator, you reset the computer and try again. If you crash in a T-38, you're done for. T-38 pilots maintain and hone their stick and rudder practices, hand-eye coordination, flight planning skills, and real-time decision-making, all while monitoring checklists and talking on the radio with air traffic controllers. Pilots and mission specialists practice aerobatic maneuvers and maintain physical fitness under high G, zero G, and negative G stresses, trying to stay comfortable breathing oxygen through a mask and wearing a helmet, gloves, and anti-G suit, and all while strapped into an ejection seat. The T-38 was a relatively inexpensive way for the crew members to increase their confidence and keep their decision-making skills sharp in a fluid environment with real-life consequences. What do I mean by real-life consequences? On October 17, 1990, I was flying a T-38 out of Ellington Field with my classmate Tom Jones in the back seat. Tom had been a B-52 pilot, so he had plenty of experience flying airplanes, but he was an astronaut mission specialist. NASA rules permitted only shuttle pilots or commanders to sit and fly in the front seat of the NASA T-38. Although Tom and I shared stick time on this flight, I was in command. We had been flying acrobatics out over the Gulf of Mexico. It was a beautiful day, no problems, a great flight. Tom was flying and I was working the radios. Returning to Ellington with just enough gas to fly one practice approach and then land, we listened to the ATIS weather pilot reports. A cold front was approaching Houston from the north. Tom and I had asked for vectors to runway 17, which would have us fly north of the airfield and then turn and make a long approach to land headed south. As we drew near to Ellington Field, we could see an ominous line of thunderstorms approaching from the north. The ATIS information was slightly old. I was getting a bad feeling. There were many planes in the area, and we could hear them on the approach control frequency asking for vectors around the storm. We needed to land immediately. I asked Mission Approach Control to cancel our practice approach and give us a vector directly to the field. "Stand by," they answered. The heavy traffic and the rapidly changing weather clearly had overwhelmed them. I could see the field directly in front of us, maybe 2 miles away. We didn't have enough gas to go anywhere else. I remembered when Apollo astronaut Pete Conrad was in a similar situation, out of gas and diverted to Bergstrom Air Force Base in Austin because of the weather. He ended up having to eject from a perfectly good airplane because he didn't have enough fuel to make the runway. I wasn't going to allow that to happen to us. The heavy, dark line of rain was almost on us, and lightning bolts hit the ground in the vicinity. I was about to lose sight of the runway. I knew I needed to declare an emergency. Recalling my earlier encounter with a hailstorm in a T-38, this was the moment I needed to take aggressive action and use all the tools I had available. I asked to proceed directly to the airfield for an immediate landing. No answer from approach control. The winds were now gusting to 35 knots. No time to wait for permission. "I am switching to tower frequency." "Approved," said the controller. I took the stick from Tom and said, "I have the aircraft." The mandatory call for a handover of flight control. I pulled back the power, slowed from 300 to 240 knots, aggressively turned left, pulled off the airspeed, and dropped the landing gear and flaps. I set up for a short right turn to runway 35, headed into the wind. "NASA 924 is right base, gear down, full stop." "Cleared to land," they replied. We touched down. Within seconds, heavy rain and high winds hammered us. I pulled off the runway and waited for the worst to pass. When I taxied back to the hangar in the heavy rain, the crew chiefs opened the hangar doors and let me taxi in with engines running. In all my years of flying for NASA, that was the only time I was ever permitted to do that. Another T-38, piloted by Shuttle Commander Ron Grab, had been right behind us. He had to divert to Galveston and land on a runway not generally approved for T-38s, as it was too short for normal landings. Why do I tell this story? Whether you're a pilot or not, one should be trained for unusual, unpredictable, and emergency events. There is no time to develop a strategy when you're in life-threatening circumstances. Years of chair flying and reviewing potentially bad situations came to use that day. If you're well prepared, the adrenaline surge allows the pilot's brain to operate at high speed, so decisions can come quickly and correctly. When lives are in danger, no one wants a pilot who panics. I cannot emphasize how much preparation came into play that day. I didn't have to hesitate or wonder what someone would think of my decision to turn off approach control and go visually directly to the tower. We had no seconds to spare. It could have ended up with us being struck by lightning, diverted without enough gas to make it to an emergency airfield, or as a smoking hole off runway 35 at Ellington. This time, Tom and I survived to brag about it and fly another day. Class training. We spent long hours in the classroom, the vast majority of our time concentrated on space shuttle systems. All astronauts had to learn about the main engines, the solid rocket boosters, the external tank, the hydraulic, electrical, environmental, propulsion, navigation, communications, and computer systems, and many more. Each system had a paper workbook that we had to read before the associated class started. There were three briefings for each system, one each given by an engineer, an operator like a flight controller, and an astronaut trainer. After the classroom sessions, we entered a low-fidelity simulator called an SST, or Single System Trainer. These were nearby and easily accessible if an ASCAN wanted to spend extra time studying a given system. There were no tests. This was the big boy program. We were all keenly aware that our lives depended on what we knew. We each felt motivated to learn as much as possible and to be able to apply that knowledge in the real world. We were mature enough to know how we could best learn and make use of this critical information. Enrichment sessions supplemented our core curriculum. These topics included Earth observation, astrophysics, living in space, the history of NASA, discussions by retired astronauts and flight directors, and visits to every NASA center. We endured a shortened version of the Land Survival Training Program at Fairchild Air Force Base in Washington, where I had completed the longer course 12 years earlier, thankfully minus the POW camp. We attended the Navy's Water Survival Training Program in Pensacola, and we took the Parachute Parasail Training Program at my old stomping ground at Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma. I vividly remembered my time as a student there when the first shuttle astronauts visited the base and inspired me to apply myself. Indeed, every ASCAN had to become scuba certified. Toward the end of our first year, we completed this long program at the Johnson Space Center pool and in Galveston Bay. On January 16, 1991, our classmate Bill MacArthur hosted a party at his home celebrating the one-year anniversary of the day we all received the call. That night, the United States invaded Kuwait to drive Saddam Hussein's army back into Iraq. We had been following the news since August, when the United States and its allies began Operation Desert Shield, the buildup of coalition forces in the Middle East. That evening, our class watched bombs go off as the war played out on national TV. Many of my fighter bomber pilot classmates would have been in the invasion, Operation Desert Storm, had they not been astronauts. Even I might have had the opportunity to support the war as a C-141 pilot. It was an historic night, and I could sense many of my classmates felt that they should have been part of it. By the time April rolled around, we were all clearly restless. We still had several months of training left in the ASCAN curriculum. We were tying up loose ends in the systems training and finishing our trips to the various NASA centers. On one trip to Stennis Space Center in Mississippi, a few men in our group started getting slightly silly and began playing practical jokes. The five women in our class decided this was just a bit juvenile. The guys were no match for Ellen Ochoa's rapid-fire comebacks. We women named the guys the Babas, meaning the bad attitude boy astronauts. The guys fired back by naming us the Wawas, the Whining Association of Women Astronauts. After 9 months of memorizing the endless NASA acronyms, we were part of the culture and coming up with our own. We couldn't help but bond into a tight-knit group after spending so much time together. We actually got along wonderfully as a class. We kept a scrapbook called the Hog Log, in which we recorded our dumb jokes or pranks and memorable quotes from our classmates. From my earliest days in pilot training, and even at the start of the ASCAN program, people thought it would be funny to nickname me Crash Collins. That name never stuck, not after they saw me in action. Somewhere along the line, I earned the call sign Mom. I enjoyed being in on the jokes and pranks, but I felt an instinctive need to keep us all focused and draw the line between fun and our serious work. I always seemed to be the one reminding the class when we needed to be somewhere at a certain time. "Yes, Mom," was the habitual reply. They also nicknamed me Mrs. Cleaver from Leave It to Beaver. NASA's managers could tell we were ready and eager to move on with our careers. Rather than make us wait until our one-year anniversary in July, our leaders assigned us to operational jobs at the nine-month point. Now we would truly become important contributors to the space program. Astronaut Support Person, aka CAPE Crusader. New astronauts don't get a flight assignment right away. You might have to work for several years in support roles until a mission comes along with your name on it. I volunteered for several jobs, but ended up in Orbiter Systems. My section leader assigned me to work an issue with the shuttle's auxiliary power units. I wasn't exactly sure how to get started, but eventually figured out that the job was basically whatever I wanted it to be. I worked on the issue with the APU controllers, as well as problems with electrical, hydraulic, environmental, and computer systems on the shuttle. I reviewed and approved changes to checklists. I answered questions for engineers and sat with them in the mission evaluation room during missions. 9 months later, Steve Nagel, the new chief of the astronaut office, asked me if I'd like to be an astronaut support person, known as an ASP or CAPE Crusader. At any given time, there were about five ASPs working at Kennedy Space Center. These astronauts were hands-on with the space shuttles and their crews, performing everything from tests in the hangar to securing the astronauts in the space shuttle for the launch. I immediately started to say yes, but Steve stopped me. He told me to think about it for a day and discuss it with my husband. He knew Pat was on the road several days a week as an airline pilot. As an ASP, I'd be at Kennedy Space Center in Florida 3 or 4 days a week. Steve wanted to be sure that we were both okay with the two of us being on travel so often, which I deeply appreciated. Of course, Pat was excited for me and was fine with my accepting the role. Our travel schedules would overlap, and we had no children to worry about. It was an easy yes. ASPs perform tasks at Kennedy Space Center that required a trained astronaut. The actual flight crew was focused on their upcoming mission, so the ASPs took care of other details to ensure that the vehicle and the crew were ready to go. I ran flight control tests on the shuttle inside its hangar, setting pressures and testing the controls. We were integral to final preparations like the airlock closeout, the crew equipment interface test, and the terminal countdown demonstration test, which was a dress rehearsal of the launch countdown. As members of the Kennedy Space Center closeout crew, we would strap in the crews before launch and help them out of the space shuttle after it landed. I also met and worked with various employees of the shuttle program. Those visits with work groups gave me great confidence in the attitude and abilities of the Kennedy Space Center crews. They were extremely dedicated and serious about what they did, whether in the tile shops, main engine installation, fire department, or a multitude of other specialties. They were all groups of dedicated professionals performing important missions, and everyone felt a part of the bigger effort of space exploration. I worked on about 10 missions during my time at Kennedy Space Center. The premier duty was assignment as the prime ASP for a mission, as a member of the 7-person closeout crew. The closeout crew wore suits with different numbers on the back. Number 1 was the team lead, the prime ASP was number 2, the quality control tech was number 7, and so forth. Closeout crew techs were highly trained, followed detailed checklists and procedures, and were all hand-picked for the job. It was an honor to work beside them. The closeout crew operated in the white room at the 195-foot level of the launch tower. We helped the astronauts don their harnesses and special equipment, and then we strapped them into their seats aboard the space shuttle. This was an emotional time when you stop to consider that the closeout crew were the last people these astronauts would see until they returned from space. The toughest job was the physical effort required to close and secure the hatch, which took plenty of strength and technical knowledge. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. This has been Margaret with Biographies and Memoirs. I've been reading from the book, Through the Glass Ceiling to the Stars, The Story of the First American Woman to Command a Space Mission by Eileen Collins, U.S. Air Force retired and NASA astronaut, with Jonathan H. Ward. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.